The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's really good to have you in our company this evening. It is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. We are going to be this evening talking hedge funds, which sounds incredibly boring, but it's not, I promise you. And the reason why it's not incredibly boring is because they're quite a controversial asset class. If you want to learn more about hedge funds, our investment school is for the complicated stuff, the stuff that needs explaining. And we've got one of the best explainers in the business tonight to be headmaster of that investment school, Director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, with us as we talk about those, as we talk about that particular issue. Hedge funds, massively controversial, huge amount of global scrutiny on them, and a whole bunch of mis-selling attached to them. So if anybody's recommended to you recently, or you may recommend to you in the future, that, oh, you should put your money into a hedge fund, it'll protect your downside. It may very well do that. But at what cost? That's what we'll look at this evening. We'll talk about why the Western Cape is winning in the national jobs race, if you like. If there was a competition, the Western Cape would be winning it. We will talk about how to raise money for your small business this evening. Also catch up on the astonishing efforts by Tesla to pay Elon Musk $56 billion. And that's an outrageous amount of money. He is the founder, of course. But it is the biggest pay packet ever attempted in global history. And we're still waiting for shareholders to approve it. US judge rejected the attempt by Tesla to pay Elon Musk that particular pay package, but they're going to revisit it. It was a deal set in 2018. So we get to talk to Andrew Woodburn, who's the managing director at AmRop Woodburn Mann, of dignity and salaries and of how companies get to these sorts of calculations and how it is even possible to contemplate that amount of money for a single human being in a single year. He already is one of the world's richest people, is Elon Musk, but it is fascinating that this is being contemplated at a time, of course, because the messaging and the timing of the messaging really sucks, that Tesla's cutting 10% of its global workforce. We'll get into that this evening on The Money Show. Also today, the Reserve Bank Governor, Lesetša Ganyaho, he is in Washington, D.C. He was speaking on Bloomberg TV, as he likes to do when he is in Washington. I don't know how he finds the time, frankly, to do all this travel. He's got all these banknotes to sign. Anyway, Lesetša Ganyaho saying that yesterday's CPI outcome, that 5.3%, the drop from January's 5.6%, is in line with its own forecasts. He's saying that the Reserve Bank is watching the Fed, but it will not necessarily follow the Fed. The US Fed, of course, has changed its tone completely on interest rate cuts. It's refusing even to talk about the possibility of cutting at the moment, simply because inflation has started rising a bit in the United States. The governor very, very clear on the bad news going into the Rand. And also the CPI framework, it needs a bit of a rejig and a rework, but he doesn't see that being changed much before the elections this year. So certainly the Reserve Bank governor, with his very strong global status, of course, being treated very seriously in Washington, D.C. Good to see.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Now, the Western Cape is the country's third biggest economy, the third biggest contributor to GDP, gross domestic product. The biggest, Gauteng, the second biggest, KZN, in third spot, the Western Cape. But it's the part of the country with the lowest rate of unemployment. It's also got the fastest jobs growth. I get that as follows. And a study carried out by Labour Market Intelligence is showing that it's been generating more jobs than other provinces consistently for more than a decade. Why? Well, Professor Hardus van Sail is the former director at the University of Johannesburg School of Economics. Hardus, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I think we know it intuitively, and we've seen the stats over a long period of time, but it's good to have the study confirm the fact that the Western Cape has become this most successful jobs creator. Do we have... I've got views on this, but do we have hard objective evidence as to why the Western Cape is outstripping the rest of the country in terms of job creation?
Bruce, it's nice to speak to you tonight. Yeah, no, they are performing very, very well. And I think if you look at the numbers, there are basically three contributing factors towards these numbers. Firstly, the tourism industry has been growing tremendously over the last few years. And then obviously all your associated downstream industries are also benefiting in terms of job creation. So that's the first major one. The second one is agriculture. So if you look at the agricultural sector of the Western Cape, also performing very, very well, especially on export markets. So they're doing very well, creating a lot of jobs there. Then there's also a tremendous increase in infrastructure expenditure and also construction expenditure in the whole of the Western Cape. You can just look at the huge semi-migration to the Western Cape, which comes from all your income groups. So there's a huge semi-migration to the Cape, and that's stimulating infrastructure. But I must say, hand in hand with that is the excellent level of good governance that you see on municipal level. So they are driving the whole infrastructure process, not only down in the metropolitan area of Cape Town, but if you go further up to big towns like George, like Mossel Bay and so forth, it is a tremendous infrastructure and construction expenditure. I think those are the three main contributing factors towards the huge job creation within the Western Cape.
I was having a private conversation with an economist last year, so I can't name names, because what he said was fairly controversial, and he said the Western Cape is going to become a victim of its own success. In a country where there is so much dysfunction in so many regions, where we're not getting jobs, where there isn't the hope of employment, you get an influx of people desperate for opportunity, and they go to where that opportunity is presenting itself. Yeah. And when you look around, particularly around Cape Town, there is an expansion of informal housing. There is an expansion of people who are coming from all over the country. Helen Ziller once got into trouble for describing a migration from the Eastern Cape, which is particularly hard hit. And people said, you can't call people in their own country migrants. But I think she made a political point there. So the Western Cape becomes increasingly attractive. And that ultimately causes a drag on the economy of the Western Cape, where it is more successful, therefore actually makes a rod for its own back in the longer term.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. You can just look at the numbers of semi-migration from Gauteng coming down here to the Western Cape, and also obviously the Eastern Cape. So that's putting a lot of pressure on especially on infrastructure within the province. But so it is a challenge for municipal governance to keep up with those pressures, to try and stimulate the economy even further. Let's hope that they are successful, but it's absolutely true what you are saying. We are seeing it here in the Western Cape.
Thank you to Professor Hardus van Sail, former director at the University of the Johannesburg School of Economics. I once asked the Premier, Alan Windey, that question about the number of people coming to the Western Cape, and he said he loves it because there are people who come into the Western Cape because they're seeking opportunity, and people who are seeking opportunity are going to bring and add value. So certainly one hopes that it doesn't become, as my economist friend suggested, a victim of its own success.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
I think we accept lobbying, and that is using influence, hopefully just soft power rather than bribes and corruption. But certainly there's been a piece of international research which has identified corporate climate lobbying in South Africa as, and I'm quoting, a significant threat to effective national climate change policy. Now, that would be a worrying trend, but is it really that unusual? The fossil fuel industry has got it's boxing in its corner. It's under attack. It feels victimized. It has got a business model that relies on it, converting coal into oil and drilling for oil and drilling for gas and producing the energy that we still need in our economies to drive us. And we can cut it all off tomorrow, but then don't expect, to have a world that you want to live in the short term. Certainly it'd be really, really quite quite tough. Tracy Davies is Executive Director at Just Share. She is part of a different kind of lobbying. And I mean, lobbying is legitimate. Lobbying is normal, Tracy. Do we have a dangerous level of lobbying when it comes to the fossil fuel industry in South Africa, as this international piece of research seems to suggest?
Before I answer that, I just have to say, nobody is suggesting that we switch off fossil fuel producers tomorrow. That has never been the argument. That is not the game. But emissions are at record highs. We are making no progress, none at all. And a big reason for that is this corporate climate lobbying. And, you know, if it's just part of the game and corporates boxing their own corner, then it certainly in South Africa is a completely unregulated and unfair and untransparent game, which benefits a few large corporate emitters at the expense of the rest of us. So, yes, you're right. My organization is a lobby group. But everything we do is put out into the public domain. The difference here is that these companies and these entities have preferential access to policymakers and to decision makers, and they use that preferential access to ensure that climate regulation is weakened and delayed. And that only benefits them at the expense of the rest of us. Look at all the news this week about increased insurance premiums, insurers who will no longer cover you for weather-related damages, 50,000 rand excesses in KZN for flood-related damage. So the impacts are hurting all of us, but it's these big guys who are playing an enormous role in making sure that we don't make progress on reducing emissions.
Explain to me this concept of preferential access, because that's an important point here in the disparity of access.
It is. In fact, it's probably the key point, right? Because when government is considering policy making and law, there are legislated public participation processes which give anyone who's interested in those laws and policies the opportunity to engage and comment on an equal footing. And what happens in these instances is that is not the process through which this lobbying takes place. Let me give you an example which will make this very clear, I hope. Several years ago, when the Mineral Resources and Petroleum Development Act, the MPRDA, was being amended, it was going through a legislative parliamentary amendment process, and I was working at the Center for Environmental Rights at that time, and we spent hours writing submissions and presenting to the parliamentary portfolio committees and trying to persuade them that our arguments were relevant. Somewhere in that process, the Offshore Petroleum Association and its lawyers held a meeting with President Zuma. When the amended draft law appeared in Parliament, it included all sorts of new clauses that no one had ever seen before and that had never been subject to public participation and which were favorable to the oil and gas industry. That's what I mean about preferential treatment. Is happening all the time in South Africa.
Are you suggesting that the sort of lobbying that we're seeing playing out here is a lobbying that includes the greasing of palms? It includes bribery. It is a corrupt process. Or is it simply one of persistent intervention in the policy process?
I think probably the latter. We have no evidence that the former is taking place. But you must remember as well that, you know, when it comes to technical things like climate change, you have business groupings with phalanxes of lawyers and technical experts meeting with government officials who are not necessarily experts in these fields. And that in itself is an imbalance in power. And they are very persuasive and they are very convincing, you know. But all of this is happening behind closed doors. So no one else gets to say to that government official, hang on, but the argument they're making there is not actually the full picture. That's not all of it. You need to also hear this side of the story. That's the purpose of legislative public participation processes. But when you can just pick up the phone and say, hi, Barbara Creasy, we need to chat. We're a bit worried about this law that's coming in. I can't do that. I don't know if you can do that, but certainly I can't do that. And so that's where this preferential access has a really very pernicious impact.
We have seen some pushback. I mean, Barbara Creasy, I think, has been the most active in her portfolio for many years in terms of pushing back against some excesses, certainly with car power ships and others. I think she's been quite courageous in the world of politics to push back against those.
Yeah, I mean, look, There are lots of different issues and lots of different approaches taken by government ministers. You could also look at SAFL and its sulfur dioxide emissions and at the many, many, many engagements that take place between SAFL and the Department of Environmental Affairs, and then look at the fact that SAFL, 15 years after that law was enacted, is still not required to comply with it and has just been given another 5 years not to comply, and ask yourself how courageous she's been in that regard.
Okay, fair comment. Thank you very much, Tracy Davies, Executive Director at Just Share. Lobby groups are all over the place, but certainly some are more active than others. Tracy Davies does her best as somebody who doesn't get the audiences that the corporate sector does get. And government is going to listen to the corporate sector, because the corporate sector is going to come with the big teams of lawyers, and also the idea, the threat that this is the amount of tax we pay, and these are the number of people we employ. Do you really want that on your conscience, on your watch? And very quickly, you will find policymakers stepping aside, I guess, in the face of that. So, yes, you've got a pernicious corporate sector, perhaps. At the same time, you've got regulators who are not doing their jobs adequately. They are not putting stuff up to public consultation in the way that they should. I think that message was very, very clear.
The Money Show.
The markets.
To Graham Kerner we go, with the Kerner perspective. And our markets look like, I don't know, there's tumbleweed. Tumbleweed, Graham. There's very little corporate news. There's very little sort of activity happening on markets at the moment. And it's all being driven out of the United States and whatever the next Fed governor chooses to say about interest rates.
Yeah, Bruce, good evening. I think that tumbleweed scenario is probably right. You just need the corny music, but it's pretty grim at the moment. The South African market, particularly if you take Richemont and Naspers and likes out of it. So if you look at the SA Inc. stocks, it's really, it's like a scene out of a really desolate Wild West movie. So it's been very tough, and I think more recently we're being pushed around by the prognosis that maybe the Fed is not going to cut as soon as everybody wanted. But I do think there's also an anxiety towards the South African market brewing, given the fact that we've got elections about 5 weeks away. And the best I can do is to say, the markets hate uncertainty more than bad news. And at the moment, there's a lot of it.
Exactly. At least with bad news, you can make a decision. With uncertainty, you're too terrified to make a decision. You've only got to look at the 12-month lows on a range of really good quality South African companies. And I'm going to just name a couple of them very, very quickly that have hit 12-month lows this week. Among them, you've got Absa, you've got Old Mutual, you've got Discovery, you've got Life Healthcare, you've got MTN and Vodacom, you've got Woolies and Netcare, all of which individually are really superlative businesses, but markets are just not interested in. I was talking to some people at Old Mutual the other day saying, you guys are performing so well. I said, please tell the stock market, because there's just so much selling happening at the moment of their shares.
Yeah, Bruce, I think, truthfully, we would probably only be interested in half of that list, but it doesn't matter. The point is that if you take this South African financial cluster, for example, banks are trading on, 6, 7, 8 PEs, dividend yields, almost what you're getting on cash. You've got a little bit of DWT, dividend withholding tax leakage, but boy, these valuations really are compelling. And if you look at the life offices and some asset managers and investment holding companies, it just, I don't want to be brazen and say it's like shooting fish in a barrel, but it does feel like that. There's just so much value around. But you've got to be a little bit brave, and you've got to look through this upcoming election. But I would argue, somebody who's, let's put it in inverted commas, trapped in South Africa with part of their retirement money, for example, you can't invest everything offshore. I really think this is a very attractive equity market in South Africa to be buying into.
Explain to me, please, the value of a dividend yield at, say, 7%, because I think it's really important that we understand the power of dividends over time. Because I was looking at a share price graph earlier of Standard Bank over the last, 30 years. And, the share price has gone from a very low level up to $100, more than a decade ago, and then has gone up to about 200 and is fluctuating around that level right now. But it's less about the share price appreciation than it is about the price you pay for a share and then the amount of profit you get to share in for a decade hence.
Yeah, Bruce, absolutely. So I think what you're saying is right, that share prices tend to be volatile. I think your point is also that, you know, if you bought the Standard Bank in 1990 or in 2000, you would be doing well in spite of the negativity that is in the South African equity market now. But I think through that cycle, if you bought Standard Bank probably in 1990, for example, you're getting more in, you know, in dividends now than you paid for the share
exactly.
back then. And you and that is powerful. And you know, if you think, for example, right now, let's say you say, you know, I'm targeting a 12% a year return. That's all I really want out of the South African equity market over a 10-year view per year. And if you can get more than half of that in the form of dividends, and those earnings and those dividends are going to improve, and eventually the market will put a sensible valuation on it, then you're getting half your targeted return in yield. It's very, very compelling. So I think what you're saying is very powerful. And in the case of Standard Bank, you know, if you just take back to the analogy we're talking about, you know, with the elections coming up and a lot of anxiety, you know, if you look back 30, 40 years, you had 1994, you had, you know, ratings downgrades, you had Nenegate, you had a whole lot of things, and time will heal. But I think people tend to ignore dividends, particularly when they're as juicy as you're getting in the financial sector in South Africa.
And Oceana came out with a trading update this morning. It was one of the few bits of corporate news we've seen this week, and it was quite refreshing to see, you know, in a market as choppy as ours, the market actually rewarding financial performance, saying, you know, these guys know where the fish are, they're catching them and processing them.
Yeah, and being rewarded with a 6% rally in the share price. And I think that's the thing, that, you know, and there are a lot of companies like us. You mentioned Old Mutual, who say, well, you know, we're doing the right things. Standard Bank, another example, you know, delivered phenomenal results in the year to December. They're not going to fall in a heap in 2024, but, you know, the market just doesn't seem to reward and recognize. But I think in this case, they were recognized. But if I look, Bruce, I think there were 170,000 odd shares traded today. You know, on a 9 billion rand market cap, it's almost nothing. And I think that is really the theme in South Africa at the moment, that there's really little interest and volume going through in smaller caps and mid caps, and even in some of the smaller top 40 counters. And that's why I'll come back to say, I think this sort of inaction that we're seeing in the South African equity market is creating opportunities. And maybe that's one example, because, you know, these companies continue to perform. They continue to take fish out of the oceans, or, you know, raise home loans and all these wonderful things. So even though the economy may not be flying, and even though there's a lot of anxiety around the economic outlook and the political outlook, you know, these companies somehow manage to just get on with it. And I think that's what we tend to forget. We think, you know, South Africa is a difficult place, you know, and by implication, it's a bad investment destination. But that's not always true. Quite often, when the bad news is more than baked in, that creates special opportunities. And I think that's where we are actually in the South African equity market.
Graham Koerner with a Koerner perspective this evening. Thank you, Graham. This Eyewitness News now at 6:30, brought to you by Khalix. Khalix for the businessman who knows what he wants. Here's Maki Molapo.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to chat to Andrew Woodburn in a moment. Andrew Woodburn, of course, is a person who hires people to do high-level jobs. He's the managing director at Amrop Woodburn Man. And in that process, of course, they help negotiate salary packages and all of that sort of thing. So he is an expert in this field. Well, I want to just test with him the renewed efforts by Tesla to pay Elon Musk $56 billion, not $1 million, $56 billion. That's more than million. We will talk to Andrew Woodburn all about that. We'll then chat to Nhlanhla Dlamini, who was about to shut down Manelli Pets until he got a lifeline. And that lifeline is proving to be very, very effective. We'll also chat this evening to Martin Machejo, the head of investment readiness at Fetola. I was at a fantastic conference today at the old Didata campus, of course. And there were hundreds of people. all gathered together, all desperately looking for insights on funding. It was a really fulfilling and good day today. So we'll chat to Martin all about business funding. Gary Boyson, our headmaster of the investment school, talking hedge funds this evening. Well, Tesla once again looking to ensure that Elon Musk can get the biggest pay deal in corporate history, $56 billion. It is asking its shareholders to vote on it. And he got a pay deal in 2018 that was rejected by a US judge in January. The US judge says it was an unfathomable sum. And I think for most of us, $56 billion for doing, you know, admittedly a lot of good work and for being innovative and creative is one thing. But $56 billion? I mean, I think you would like to get a pay packet for anybody you placed. Managing Director at AMROP Woodburn Man, Andrew Woodburn. If you could get $56 billion for your clients, I think you'd have people lining up around the block.
Good evening, Bruce, and to the listeners. I think I might be able to run a small country on that kind of money.
No, exactly right. I mean, it is an astonishing amount of money. Is there any justification on this planet for one human being to be paid that amount of money?
So, Bruce, this is not the first time this kind of question's been asked. By the way, in South Africa, we have our own cases of where this sort of instrument has been used. And I'll take you back to our own Koos Becker at Naspers, who, yep, in fact, was paid a pittance on a yearly basis and was executing exactly the same form of remuneration. And what that means is they aren't actually cheating. They agree with the company that they will work into the future and not really even take a salary. In fact, it's reported that Elon Musk has not been paid a salary for 6 years. And in lieu of that regular salary, they will bet, because essentially it's a bet on themselves, that they will deliver value to the marketplace and they will take part in that reward. So if you were a shareholder 6 years ago and you bought a Tesla share, Elon Musk was awarded 12% of the equity at that point in time. But he didn't take the money or the shares. They stay in a sort of trust with the company. And 6 years later, he gets rewarded the increased value on that 12%. And that just happens to be calculated at the magic $56 billion. So Koos Becker did a similar thing. Another guy called Leon Kokinas in the famous African bank also followed this kind of routine. And so within corporate law, this is an established and recognized methodology for paying a CEO who either as founder or takes risk alongside other shareholders. But of course, there's another side to the coin that you've been explaining, and that is, how can one justify a payout of $56 billion? So on the one side, the board is saying to its shareholders, well, we have to uphold the law. We made this agreement, and now it's time to pay the piper. But here in South Africa, Bruce, you and the listeners will know of a little thing called the King Code of Corporate Governance.
Yes.
The King Code says, well, there's a little element or a little thing on King 4 called corporate citizenship. And part of that says, well, how can you honestly pay someone this amount of money if you are reducing headcounts by 10%, the actual share in the last 6 months is down by 37%, and so on and so on. And so at this point in time, as you mentioned yourself, the timing stinks. But it strikes me that there is an element of legal responsibility in, sure, the back end. And I think that is why the board is coming back to shareholders again. But actually, it just doesn't tie up. The optics is terrible.
Yeah.
And one would have thought by now that corporate, global corporates would have learned that one doesn't or shouldn't award this massive single payout, but rather develop techniques where part of the award is delivered to the individual over a period of time, and hence sort of slow down on these massive payouts. But honestly, when I did the research for you, Bruce, and for our listeners, and simplifying it, there's no clear answer to this. Should they pay or shouldn't they pay? It's not an easy one.
No, exactly right. I mean, yes, they should pay, because if there's a legal agreement between Elon Musk and the board went into it willingly and the company has done considerably better than ever anybody could have anticipated, well, good luck to him. As with Koos Becker, who backed his entry into China and the bet on Tencent, and Koos Becker acknowledges quite clearly that he got lucky and has made, you know, certainly, I think, several tens of billions of rand, which is not $56 billion, but he's made good money out of the risk that he took by not being paid a salary by Naspers. He had private means at the time that he could afford to take that risk, and he has been well rewarded for it. When it comes, however, and it is precisely to the point where in the same week as Elon Musk says it's the hardest thing he's ever had to do, it's something he doesn't like to do, but really for the sustainability of Tesla, he has to cut 10% of the workforce. In that same week, the company then says, we're having another go at paying him this $56 billion. It is about the optics, and the optics aren't the law, but it just does send a terrible signal, unfortunately, as to, you know, what is often deemed to be wrong with the corporate sector.
100%, and we don't like that to happen. We like things to be fair and well aligned. And so I think maybe they're not providing the detail. The interesting thing here is the court case, Bruce, wasn't about the quantum of the payout. The court case was about the fact that this deal 6 years ago was done in shady circumstances, and the board might not have been independent because his brother was on the board, and so on and so on. And so unfortunately, these are all things which, by the way, we're not surprised by when we talk about Elon, who likes to be big and bold and different, and it's paid off so far. But in fact, this is not what we would call clean, good corporate citizenship or governance. And so either way, the free market doesn't need these kinds of things surfacing.
Thank you, Andrew Woodburn, the managing director at Amrop Woodburn Man. Thanks very much for giving us some perspective, some clarity, and a local flavor to a very big global story. In a moment, a guy who was worried that he was about to go bust and got a lifeline that seems to be paying off. Pick up on that tale in a moment.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, supermarket groups get lots of criticism for the way their suppliers are treated, generally speaking. Not in every case, but depending on their bargaining power, they're required to supply product, do the merchandising, and if it doesn't perform, remove the stock and not expect to be paid for months at a time. But at the same time, the only way to get any scale and reach into the consumer market is via the expansive networks that the supermarkets provide. ShopRite's been pretty good at letting us know over time when it takes on smaller suppliers, and in each case it becomes an opportunity for an entrepreneur to showcase not only their goods but their talent for scaling up. And Nhlanhla Dlamini is the founder of Maneli Pets, which makes animal food. You founded in 2016, Nhlanhla. Why did you choose pet food as a category? It's a massively competitive, corporate dominated sector. Where did you see a gap?
Good evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. The opportunity that I spotted was actually more around the export markets initially. South Africa has some really unique proteins like ostrich, venison, warthog that the rest of the world doesn't have. And I wanted to export those to the US, to Europe, and to parts of Asia. So that's how we got our foothold into the pet industry. And subsequently, we then also got into South African pet shops, and then vets, and ultimately into retailers. So it's just exports first and then into the South African retail space.
You then hit the problem that every single manufacturer in South Africa hits, but I think you had some very specific issues when it came to the small matter of load shedding. And of course, you know, one says, well, then get generators. But they're expensive, and they're expensive to run, they're expensive to install, and banks weren't at that particular point in time that keen on funding them, were they?
No, certainly not. And especially for SMEs, banks in South Africa are more prone to fund big businesses with steady cash flows and a long history of trading. We only started less than 10 years ago, and we're still relatively small. So when load shedding started getting really bad, and that was about 2 years ago, we first for about 5 months thought that it was a phase and it would pass. So we weren't actually taking any measures to work around load shedding. But as the year wore on, we realized that we actually do need to raise funding to try and find a solution. And thank goodness, ShopRite Checkers was, the ShopRite group rather, was willing to hear us out to help us install the inverters and the batteries that we needed on a funding basis.
Explain that and how it worked, because it's quite an important thing, because here you are effectively getting some vendor financing. You've got a willing buyer for your product who knows that they can't get your product, and you're on the cusp of going bust if you don't get some support somewhere. and they're now taking the risk of funding the installations that you need, and you're doing probably quite a complicated structured deal in terms of getting that access to the funding for the alternative energy at the same time as a route to market.
Yes, it was atypical, and it was a reflection of the times. I really was desperate, as many South African factories and businesses were at the time.
Were you supplying ShopRite at the time? Sorry, that's an important point. Were they a customer?
Yes, they were. Okay. So we started supplying them in 2021, and at that point, we had already scaled to over 200 shops nationally. So I think that certainly helped that we were a credible supplier. We had a trading record with them. But they saw that our supply was waning and our ability to scale was really impaired by load shedding. So I proposed or I suggested that could you structure a loan or a package where we could pay you off over time and you can tell that we are growing in your business. So you've got that surety. And it wasn't an easy sell, certainly wasn't, but I'm glad that we met at a point where it actually was workable. And they aren't the only funders to this project. There are two other funders that assisted in making this happen. But ShopRite Group was certainly the most instrumental in getting this across.
What have you learned in this process? Because, I mean, often the supermarket groups, as I mentioned earlier, are very criticized for the business models and the structure and the way in which they do deals. ShopRite, certainly, I don't know about other groups. They haven't let us into their trade secrets. ShopRite occasionally gives us a glimpse when it suits them, and this suits them. But what have you learned through the process as to what is possible and what can actually move the dial for small and medium enterprises in our economy?
I've learned a few things. One, retailers are tough when they have to be, but that's mostly related to them wanting the best for their consumers. They really do press suppliers to make sure that you're delivering the best quality, the best costing, and consistently for the benefit of their consumers, which I respect and I understand. In the period that we're in and facing the crisis that you're facing, and it really was a crisis, one of my lessons was speak up. You can't be struggling on your own. And thank goodness I did speak up to ShopRite Group about what we're going through. We had to open up our books, but it was a very fair and honest conversation. So speak up. A lot of retailers are actually fair and willing to hear you out if you're doing what you can.
And Nhlanhla, I'm delighted that you've survived to see another day. Are you back on an even keel? Are you back on an even footing? Are you growing? Have you got a margin of safety rebuilt into the business again?
Yes, finally. The solar was successfully installed last month. We've been operating seamlessly for the last 25 days.
Because we haven't had any load shedding for the last 25 days.
Ironically. Long may it last. But yeah, it's been such a relief to be back in business, operating well, growing in South Africa and also exporting again for the first time in 1.5 years. So we're in a much better space right now than we were a year ago and 2 years ago.
Nhlanhla Dlamini, thank you, the founder of Maneli Pets.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP, and I love great stories. I really do. I love stories of success. I love stories of people who are gutsy. And when they get into trouble, they find solutions. And I just love the story that we shared just before Eyewitness News. If you missed it, I do suggest that you go. Well, every day I suggest that you go and get our podcast, of course. But the story that we did just before Eyewitness News with the founder of Maneli Pets and Nhlanhla Dlamini, against the ropes, through no fault of he or his colleagues' own, finding themselves just unable to function and to fulfill their contracts and therefore getting some help and some corporate help, getting the supply chain, getting everything working out, and they're back on their feet. Ironically, of course, it was a power shortage thing, and for the last month they've been operating seamlessly with their new generating power. I can't imagine that load shedding is over. I suspect load shedding is well suspended, and I'm delighted that the grid seems to be holding up well and everything seems to be going swimmingly. However, we are still very much in a power deficit, which is a continued risk for companies. I'm sure that that investment is going to show that it was worthwhile. You do feel like a bit of a twit when you're the one who takes a defensive measure and then the thing you took a defensive measure against proves to no longer be a problem. I'm not too sure that that's the case with electricity. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. We'll talk to Retief Gerber in just a moment. He is the co-founder of a really interesting business called Spatial Edge, and it's in the world of AI. But what's not in the world of AI anymore? Everybody's got AI, even if it's just some person sitting in the corner messing around with ChatGPT. But this is bigger than that. We'll also talk to Martin Machejo, who is the head of investment readiness at Fitola. And I was at the forum in Bryanston today at a big conference, all aimed at really opening doors and eyes and illuminating the possibilities of funding for small businesses. And it really was an uplifting event. Director at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, with us this evening, talking hedge funds. A hedge fund's massively controversial, but we'll understand them better. It is the investment school, after all.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
So how do you make better business decisions? Most people would tell you nowadays, you need to focus on the data. But which data? And if you've got data analytics to tell you exactly what's happening in your business, but you consider the vast amount of data that is circulating in every single business today, there is data which, as Jeff Bezos puts it, sometimes the data screams, and that's very obvious, but sometimes the data whispers. Now you've got to be able to tell the difference. You've got to find out the data that whispers, and sometimes the data, there's probably some data you should be ignoring. How do you tell the difference? Well, Retief Gerber is dedicating his life to this challenge. He's chief executive and co-founder at Spatial Edge. They've just raised a hefty 60 million rand in investment from Hlaisani Capital. And you call yourselves Data and Applied AI Solutions Company, Retief, in English. And if you can translate it with subtitles, what would a data and applied AI solutions company do when it wakes up in the morning?
Good evening, Bruce. It's quite a difficult question. I think the biggest thing is, as you were saying, there's a lot of data out there, and figuring out which is applicable and which is not. I think the best way to do that is to throw that data at a lot of computing power and using it to help figure that out. And I think the thing that keeps us out is to apply that figuring out to businesses and you know, giving them the right data to make the right decisions and to give them a view of what the impact of those decisions would be. So, you know, what's the expected outcome if you make that decision?
Now, if you threw data at a computer and I threw data at a computer, there'd be two very different outcomes. Is it a case of rubbish in, rubbish out, and you've got to be very selective before you put the data in? Or are we at a stage of evolution of AI yet where you can put all the data in and actually get some sensible answers out of the machine once it's gone through everything?
Well, at the moment, we're still at a phase where you need quite specialized and clever people that can sort of be in between the data and the machine. I don't think we're at a point yet where the machines can figure that out on their own. And that's kind of where the data scientists come in. They are the ones that look at what the machines can give back and figuring out if it's useful or not.
Do you see your mission as putting data scientists out of work? I mean, not as callously as that, of course, but I mean, do you see a medium or longer term future where those specialized and clever people who at the moment are putting the data in are no longer going to be required? Because part of AI, of course, is machine learning, and you've got machine learning capability which you've built over the last 7 or 8 years.
Well, I think the part that's still probably going to be missing for a long time is, you know, the big part with the machines is figuring out the patterns, but figuring out where the patterns are going to be useful and how it's going to impact a business and change a business is still very tactical. So the people who's been in a business that understands the nuance is still critical. So our systems typically use them. And the same applies for the data scientists. So we don't see the machines getting that clever anytime soon that it's not necessary anymore.
Which I think for data scientists, the sighs of relief in data science world tonight, they really are. But it is it becomes the tool then that I suppose amplifies the ability of people to go through vast quantities of data far more quickly than they've ever been able to do and process that information possibly far more quickly than they've ever been able to do in the past.
Yeah, no, definitely, 100%. I think Steve Jobs said the computer when it came out is the bicycle for the mind. So you've got to think of this thing as sort of the motorbike or the car for the mind that, you know, just takes it a level up.
Is it a is it a 50cc moped or is it a 1000cc MotoGP bike?
So I think the potential is for it to be a MotoGP bike. I think, you know, everyone starts with small steps. So
we're still at 50cc level.
Yeah. Probably, you know, a little bit of that. There's obviously businesses and environments that's a little bit further than that. But we're still early days. So still a lot of things that needs to be figured out.
Well, what's really interesting is you seem, and again, this is from what I've been able to piece together in an industry that I really don't understand nearly well enough yet, but you seem to have operated in a fairly closed environment, working for very specific clients for a period of time, 6-7 years now. And you've almost been incubating yourselves as you've learned and grown and developed alongside your clients. And now the 60 million rand that you've raised provides you with the first opportunity to take what you've learned and make it more commercially available.
Correct. Yeah, I think it's been a very deliberate way of going about things. It's not the first business I've started. It's not the first business I've got funding for. I think the earlier businesses, it was a typical engineer sitting in a room with an idea, building a product, and then trying to take it to market. So we very deliberately decided to practice what we do in an environment where we can really see whether it works out the way we expect. Does it deliver the value? How complex is it to get these systems to work within enterprise environments? So it's definitely been very deliberate part of our learning curve. And as we've learned and experiment and gotten more things right, we obviously went on the path to see, okay, how does one scale this? How does one make this better, faster, and more accessible to more businesses?
So what's been the benefit then for your clients? So you've got the likes of Pep and Vodacom and other big corporates on your client list. They're published on your website. What's been the advantage for them to come and sort of learn using their systems and their information?
We didn't arrive there with no knowledge at all. So I think it is a collaborative effort. And I think the biggest advantage of a collaborative effort is the fact that it is very visible to them what is going on and how it works. So, you know, a lot of other providers come with a black box and then the business doesn't really understand what's in the box and how it works. And, you know, if your business becomes reliant on it, not knowing what's going on is a big risk. So I think the biggest benefit in that regard is they see and know everything that's going on. The other benefit is, you know, we get feedback from our clients in terms of how valuable our work has been. And, you know, in the 7 years in our accounts, we're sitting at about a 5 billion rand improvement that we've created for our customers. So that's the other part of the benefit. They can see it in their income statement and balance sheet and things. Yeah.
So it's been a mutually beneficial sort of learning process at the very sort of cutting edge, I suppose, of ever-evolving technology.
Yes, yes. And it's a win-win for both parties. So it's been good for both. All of us.
We're going to talk about business funding in just a second. And I wonder, Ritty, if you talk to yourself about yourself as being the engineer who's built solutions and has gone out to look for funding to commercialize those. Has funding become easier as you've got a better track record and as you've got, I suppose, to know people better and people have got to know you?
There's definitely something that comes with experience. And I think, you know, having something that has failed has helped, and I think the benefit that comes with all of those learnings does make it easier. You know, I think in an environment, if you build a good business with sound fundamentals, and you're not just reliant on investment, investment becomes easier. And I think that's kind of the main thing. Your business model should never be raising money from investors. Then it's difficult to raise money.
Good point. Thank you very much, Retief Gerber, this evening. Chief Executive and Co-Founder of Spatial Edge is the name of the company. They have raised 60 million rand that will allow them to commercialize the offering, which they've built effectively in partnership with corporate clients. It's a smart way of building a business.
702.
Bruce is on the Money Show.
Well, let's go to more basic kinds of funding, the sort of funding that so many people ask me about all the time. I went to my bank, I asked them for business funding, and they wouldn't give it to me. We had this wonderful discussion with the SAB Foundation the other day, and we just talked about the paper trails that most people have when they're in startup phase. And you've got people with great ideas who are hungry for growth, and they just don't have, one, the capacity, two, the interest, three, the time necessarily to keep good financial records. And so they go off to a bank and say, I've got this great business, it makes me a living, and now I need some funding to help it grow. And the bank or the funder immediately goes, well, let's see your financial statements. And they go, oops. And then we get people throwing, you know, calling banks' names and saying, nobody ever wants to fund us, the banks are useless, la la la, etc., etc. And I promise you this, and one thing I learned today at this fabulous investment conference that happened at the Forum in Bryanston is just that there is this literally a wall of money that is so eager to be employed, that are so eager to be invested in the best ideas, of which there are many in South Africa, but there is a disconnect in the system. So to help us connect the dots, Martin Matejo, who is the head of investment readiness at Fetola, and it is about investment readiness, isn't it, Martin? You've got a good idea, but are you actually ready for anybody else to investigate your good idea to see whether or not they're willing to risk their hard-earned money in investing in you?
Thanks a lot, Bruce, for having me. And yeah, definitely, man. It's sometimes I tend to liken it as, you know, someone seeing you naked. If, you know, an investor wants to see the full inner workings of your business, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs don't want to reveal that part of themselves because it tends to expose the lack of management or the lack of control and the lack of, you know, structures that need to be in place. But in actual fact, that's exactly what they want to see, because then you get to see where the money is going. So all you need to do is just package that nakedness a bit more, and there you go. That's all someone wants to see in order to find you.
Absolutely. Get some decent underwear before you go out in the day. I mean, and that's really the most important aspect of it, as of course, because there are different kinds of funding, of course, that SMEs need to look out for. And not all funding is equal for all SMEs. And I wonder if you can simply sort of explain for an SME perspective. We're not yet getting to venture capital and big money. But from an SME perspective, what sorts of funding are typical in that environment? You've got the bank of mom and dad, if you're lucky enough to have that, friends, fools and family, and maybe if you're really good at what you do and you've got some financial statements, maybe a bank will lend you money, but it doesn't have to stop there.
Not at all. So, I mean, yes, if you have run out of uncles and cousins to try and skim money off, you know, there is the bank, but then the bank does, you know, the bank then passes on the risk associated with your business over to you, and you pay that in the form of interest. So quite often you find that for a small business that's a bit too steep, and they then need to find other ways. Now, the one issue that we tend to have in our economy is entrepreneurs don't like to give away their equity. So this is the shares that they currently sit with. So similarly with the previous guy who was on right now, you get to raise quite significant amounts of money if you just essentially sell off some portion of your shares. Now, there's instruments that you can use in order to make sure that you still have control of that. So you can either get a loan that then converts into shares, or you get shares that convert into loans. That allows you a level of control throughout your business. So while you're busy scaling, you know, whether you're expanding or whether you are still proving that there is a market out there for you, or you've just reached the ceiling and you need to diversify what you're doing. You know, these are just two ways in order to do this. There's also purchase order funding, you know, in case you're just cash strapped right now. There's new models called invoice discounting. which is essentially a loan that says, okay, your debtors aren't paying you, so here's a loan that you can just hold on to, and then once your debtors pay, you can pay us back with a little bit of a premium. You know, it's there's multiple new ways that have come around in the space of small business financing that allow the entrepreneur to still maintain the level of control and maintain the level of authority and still be able to guide their direction. So, yeah, I mean, those are just a couple more. There's also something called a working capital advance, which is I'm cash strapped, I'm busy selling goods, and I just need a couple of rands to get me through to month end or to cover salaries. I know things are coming in later on. And you can get that. And all of those are available in the South African market, but it just takes time in order to just dig deep and find all of them.
And again, you can't have the expectation that anybody in the world owes you a favor just because you've got what your mom has told you is the cleverest idea, my darling, that I've ever heard. You are brilliant. You are special. Well done. And you get patted on the head by mom. Trevor Manuel once described it, and I wish I could get the explanation exactly right, but he was describing it as being, you know, you win a beauty contest, but your mother's the judge. This isn't that kind of thing where... You know, this isn't you know, what people tell you how wonderful you are. You've got to prove how wonderful you are to others. How do we ensure that we put our best underwear on, and using your analogy, to go for that examination?
Look, the first step is honestly build a good business. You know, from the fundamentals, make sure that you know exactly what is going on, you know who is buying your stuff, and you know why they're buying that stuff from you. You know, it seems a bit trivial to just mention it, but when you think of it, if you're able to quantify, you're able to put a number to how many people want to buy this, I don't know, this toothpick. You know, if you know how many people want to buy it, then you know why they're buying it from you. You just look for the exact same caliber of this individual and just scale it out over the course of whatever region you're looking for. That is the fundamental purpose of building a good business. You're building it, you know exactly who's buying it. Then from there onwards, just sell. You know, it's the core fundamental. If you are running a good business that is making money, and the next step is you are recording that it is making good money. So there it gets lost. If you're not recording it, kind of doesn't exist. It's sitting in your head and in the heads of those who believe in, you know, the things that you're saying. So there needs to be a paper trail of sorts that says, okay, I actually sold this toothpick. I sold 13 of these toothpicks in 2010. I am selling 13,000 of them. If that is not visible and it's just sitting in bank accounts and, you know, new houses and, you know, landscape grass, there won't be any visualization, and an investor won't have the ability to trust what you're presenting to them. And lastly, just take your time.
No, but that's it. I mean, a lot
just
of
take your time, learn it.
A lot of people who are struggling in this space, Martin, will say to you, but hold on a second, how do I build my business without capital? I mean, the reason I need money is because I need to get started. Once I get started, it'll be easy, they think. And so I need money at the beginning, not 1 year or 2 years in the future, because I can't get started with the world's best idea that my mom was told me I was such a clever boy for thinking about. So I need money now. And it does, I suppose, come down to the question is, when is the right time to look for funding? Because it's probably not on the morning that you dreamed up the idea.
No, not at all. I mean, piggybacks on the point I was going to say, you know, take your time. You do the research, you do the right level of digging deep, and you discover exactly how in order to do what you're doing. Once you are there, I mean, if you present something that has good, you know, revenue generation potential, it will intrigue even the most jaded of individuals. And luckily, we at Fetola run programs where we help entrepreneurs build it from the grassroots level. You know, you are still thinking of how you're going to create this. We will then help you along this journey. And there's products that we offer in order to just provide that patient capital in order to bring them along the journey. And there's multiple organizations that exist out there, you know, and all it needs is the time dedicated to it. The amount of time, if you quantify the time that you are spending into it, that is the value in which you're supposed to derive in the getting the capital. So if you're spending 8 hours a day researching this and you're saying your time is worth 200 Rand an hour, if you spend a month, that is significant and you should be able to get an investment of that size. You know, if you just deploy exercises like that, trust me, they will come back to you and thank you directly, Bruce.
It's such a valuable input, Martin. Thank you very, very much indeed. The head of investment readiness at Fetola. Do you agree with the panelists, by the way, that I had on various panels and things this morning as we were exploring all of these activities, that there is a huge amount of money that is sitting in at all levels of business funding that is aching to be deployed, and it's finding it really hard to deploy it because people aren't getting to the state of readiness you've been describing this evening? Oh,
100%.
Oh, sorry, I thought you'd left. I was worried. I had this wonderful question, and I thought you'd left, but you haven't. So, sorry. Yes, Martin.
Yes, so there is a ridiculous influx of funding available in the market. Even with all of these instruments that I covered earlier, there's the whole plethora of them that are available to the entrepreneurs. However, the entrepreneurs are not aware that there's all of this funding that's available, and those who are don't have the time and the care and the patience in order to prepare themselves, you know, to develop this. So investment readiness is not destination at which you have finally reached the funding, but it is a process. It's a resilience building of the business, of the individual. You know your vision, you know where you are going, and you know how to market, sell your business, you know how to attract enough revenue, you know how to package it in the form of a proper set of financials that is visible to all. You know, it's a step-by-step process that you take once you do the introspection that says, I have reached a glass ceiling where I am. I can't grow any further. I need to diversify, or I need to expand, and I need to expand quickly. There's a market opportunity. Market. You know, it's once they're able to identify that, it's just a matter of packaging your ability to take over that opportunity. But that requires the time, the level of dedication, preparation, and the guidance. Obviously, no man is an island. You do need assistance, and one should reach out for assistance when they do need help. Again, I am available, and there's numerous organizations that are out there available. But the time, care, and dedication that is required is not currently being employed by the entrepreneurs, because unfortunately, they're out there making money. So all of this money just sits, this investment fund, all these investment funds just sit hanging over the heads of the entrepreneurs, and they don't have the enough time to, in order to reach up to get it. So we are trying to plug that gap, which, you know, it requires that level of care, patience, and dedication. But I implore any entrepreneur who's listening, any small businessman, if your intention is to secure funding for your business, the journey started yesterday when you discovered that you needed the funding. Yeah. The next step is to prepare all of your information, and you're golden.
Martin, thank you. Martin Machejo, Head of Investment Readiness at Fetola. Eyewitness News time, but first I must just tell you, Gary Boyson has arrived. He's wearing, you know, one of those academic mortarboards that old headmasters used to wear. He's got an academic gown, and he's got a very flexible...
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Headmaster of the Investment School this evening is Gary Boyson. Gary is a director at Rand Swiss. And Gary, hedge funds are controversial. A lot of people know that hedge funds are controversial. A lot of people don't know why hedge funds are controversial. Before we go into, and he's looking at me slightly perplexed, but that's fine. This is why we have the Investment School, because it is to learn. Let's go right to very, very basics. What is a hedge fund?
Well, hedge fund, I suppose now there's actually a classification. You're classified as a hedge fund. So if you're classified as a hedge fund, you become a hedge fund. But, you know, in times gone by, it would essentially be a limited partnership, and it had different characteristics from a normal fund. And the main differences were that it carried higher fees, but also you could go long and short. So you could bet on markets going up or down. You also could use leverage. So you could gear up and get these exaggerated returns by using by buying more money, more instruments than you actually had money to buy.
Okay, you're using the words of hedge funds and the and the jargon of hedge funds, and you've hardly even begun yet. Yeah. Going long and short, I think we understand it.
Betting on going up and down.
You can bet whether a company is going to go up or going to go down, and that's fine. Mm. Then you talk about leverage, and that just explain the concept of leverage, because this is where it gets very technical, and for ordinary people who are being advised to get into and invest in a hedge fund, don't understand the mechanics of 100%. These things, and that's why it's dangerous for all people.
I think so, and that's why, you know, with hedge funds in South Africa specifically, you get qualified QIF and RIF, which is a retail hedge fund and a qualified investor hedge fund. And qualified investor hedge funds, you know, you actually first normally there's R1 million entry, but two, you have to have demonstrable knowledge that you understand the implications of the investment and the strategy that you're following, because as you say, they are complex. But your question about leverage is gearing. It's essentially borrowing money that you get, you use the money that you get given to invest to put down a margin deposit. So you put down a little bit of that as collateral,
and then you
get more money, and then you can buy more assets than you actually have.
You could, and there you're betting on either something going up or going down, but eventually using other people's money, you're borrowing it and saying, if it goes up, I'm betting it goes up, and
it's
I'm
going to make, give you an exaggerated return. So the easiest way to think about
an exaggerated loss.
An exaggerated loss. So the easiest way to think about it is an example of a house. So when you buy house, you might have R100,000 deposit and you go and buy a R1 million house. Then your house goes up by 10%, hopefully, and it goes to R1.1 million. Now you can sell that house. Sure, you borrowed R900,000 that you've got to pay back to the bank. But when you pay back the bank the R900,000 plus whatever interest, however long it took for that asset to grow, you're going to have R200,000. So you started with R100,000 deposit. It went up 10% and now suddenly you have R200,000 deposit. So in that case, you had 10 times gearing, as in you had a 10% move in the underlying asset, but you managed to achieve 100% return on your initial margin deposit, which is your deposit for your house.
Or you took the R100,000 deposit, you paid it on the house, you got a R900,000 loan, you cancelled the homeowner's insurance, the house burned down, and now you've got R900,000 in debt and no asset.
Absolutely. And you're in a lot of trouble. And that's, I think, one of the big fears around hedge funds, that traditionally when investors think about risk in terms of investing in a fund, they think about volatility. You think, how much is that little line, that little chart going up and down? You know, is there a 10% drawdown, but you expect the distribution to be normal. So you expect the returns to sometimes be up, sometimes be down, but you don't really consider the systemic risks, or what's called the fat tail risks. And those are so, so prevalent in hedge funds, because the distribution, I know I'm getting technical, is actually skewed. So what happens there is you're terrified of these black swan events that come around, because the hedge fund can show very low volatility. It can show almost a cash-like return, but then suddenly something happens that is unexpected.
9/11 happens.
The subprime collapse or
COVID.
COVID. And suddenly the assumptions that these hedge funds are based on, and you have a lot of leverage inside there, and those are the black swan events of your house burning down, for example. And that's one of the big risks around hedge funds. And why I think the traditional metrics of measuring hedge funds, you need to understand these. You need to understand a lot more when investing in them. And I think our regulation in South Africa does protect us from that, but it's definitely something to be cognizant when going into hedge fund investments.
Okay, let's focus if we can. You spoke about QIF, Qualified Investor Funds, and RIF, Retail Investor Funds. Let's talk about retail investor funds. Are they simpler and less geared and less leveraged than the QIFs?
They are, but it's the access point, and it's also the way that they're structured. So that there are additional limits essentially on them. But also the minimums are, you know, you generally would have an advisor on it, and the minimums are, it's more accessible essentially. So instead of having to go into a QIF where you have to put R1 million into the fund, you can literally go and do a R500 deposit. But even then, it's still advisable to have someone that is looking after that for you, because it is still going to be considered an alternative investment. It's still not something that you should go and say, let me go and put 50% of my portfolio in this. It's still always going to be classed as that alternative component in your asset allocation.
And there was a time where hedge funds were not regulated, where it was the Wild West of investing. And, you know, if you saw a good hedge fund manager, you bet on the hedge fund manager rather than understanding necessarily the underlying strategies. You went, well, they've got a good track record, let me throw money in their direction. And then you end up trusting blindly, perhaps, in the individual.
I think that's still that's still a lot of the way that you know, funds and hedge funds are analyzed. So, you know, a lot of people use the five P's approach, which is, you know, you look at the price, which is essentially the fees. Now, as I said, hedge funds are typically a lot higher than a standard long only equity fund. You know, the typical charge on a hedge fund is 2.20. So you get the 2% management fee. So every year you're going to pay 2%, but then a 20% outperformance fee of their benchmark. Now, usually a benchmark is, you know, what you're measuring against. Now, normal funds, if you've got a general top 40 equity fund, you're benchmarking probably against the top 40 or maybe the SWIX or something like that. So, you know, it's kind of fair. But hedge funds generally benchmark against STEFI, which is essentially the cash rate. So you can get these big outperformances of your benchmark, and then you've got to pay 20% of that outperformance to the fund manager. So they can be, as I say, expensive. But the five P's, one is price. The second is the people, and I think the people that run the hedge fund is absolutely critical when you're looking at it. And I mean, there's some amazing examples of successful hedge funds in South Africa, and I'm sure you've interviewed a lot of the hedge fund managers. But if you look at something like the Peregrine Pure Hedge or the Peregrine High Growth, I mean, the bylines of that, they were launched in around 1998 and 2000, the two funds. And you know, the one has never had a negative year, and the other has, the initial investors have more than 100 times their money that they invested. So fantastic performance, but it's, you have to look at those people. And then the other P, I suppose, is also, you know, the performance. What is the track record behind this fund? So that's important. I think you've also got to consider when looking at hedge funds is the whole concept of survivorship bias. You might look at it and say, those are some great people running that fund. You know, the fees may be a little bit expensive, and hey, that performance was absolutely amazing. But there is something in markets called survivorship bias as well.
Which is what?
The ones that succeed survive. The ones that don't disappear, and they're no longer on the table for you to choose from. And you might look at a long track record of a great fund, and they probably are a great fund, but you don't look at the table and think of the littered corpses of all the dead hedge fund managers, the people that just didn't make it because they were too risky, or they picked the wrong things, or they just couldn't get the returns and eventually had to shut their funds up.
So how then do we make a decision to invest in a hedge fund, even a small proportion of your money? What sort of questions should you be asking? And you're not going to have access to the fund manager directly. You will have access to a financial advisor who may be recommending that you put some of your money into a hedge fund. What sort of questions do you need to be asking them? That question to Gary Boyson, who is a director at Rand Swiss, in just a moment.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Gary Boyson, director at Rand Swiss. So, financial advisor says, Gary, you're a smart guy. You've got really good investments everywhere. You need to be taking a little bit of risk in the market, but at the same time, you need to be getting a hedge against risk. We're in a very volatile time. Goodness knows what Vladimir Putin's going to do next. Goodness knows what Xi Jinping could do next. Goodness knows what's going to happen in the American election, the Indian election, the UK election, the South African election. You need to protect yourself. And the old-fashioned way of understanding hedge funds is that they would protect you against downside in financial markets, but also allow you to enjoy significant upside. You don't necessarily get all of the upside when upside happens, but you don't also get all of the downside. That is classically what hedge funds were created to provide, a hedge, a protective mechanism. They're all like that anymore, are they?
Yeah, yes and no. So the first hedge fund ever created was 1949. It was a market neutral hedge fund. So what they were trying to do at that stage was actually separate market risk from equity risk. So they were trying to take out, something happens with Putin, then all stocks fall. They wanted to separate that from the equity risk, the underlying shares that they were investing in. They just wanted to take that risk, and you create a long short strategy essentially to do that, and it was called the market neutral strategy, very successful. But looking at it, it's not actually about trying to be negatively correlated. So when markets go down, your hedge fund exposure goes up. That's not what you're trying to do. What you're actually trying to do is just get a non-correlated exposure. So sometimes when markets go down, you might go up. Sometimes when markets go down, you might also go down. Sometimes when markets go up, you might go down. You want something that is totally unrelated to the global forces that drive so many other asset classes. And as we saw, as we came out of COVID, as we went into the Ukraine-Russia conflict, we had this inflation surging, interest rates going up. What happened is we saw 2002, 2022, We had equity markets on a very, very negative tilt, just kind of collapsing all year because of the high interest rates. We had bond markets collapsing as well. Yeah. And those are two major asset classes that suck in most of the international assets, highly correlated. So you might have thought, oh, I'm going to be a little bit more safe. I don't want to be in high growth equity. I want to be in this kind of medium growth balanced, you know, kind of heavy bond portfolio. Unfortunately, they both went down at the same time. Yeah. And that's where your hedge funds would come in. Now, they might also have gone down. But the point is, you need to understand the last P, which is process, which is what is happening inside that hedge fund? What are you getting when you invest? Because there are a lot of different types of hedge funds. And what you want to understand is, if the whole market has this, what are these guys doing that is going to be different? So if you're an investor trying to understand what you're, it's always the same advice. Try and understand what you're investing in.
Very few people, however, and I'm generalizing here and I'm willing to be shot down on it, but I think this is a safe assumption. When they sit across the table from their financial advisor speaks to them and will be, I'm sure, a great communicator and be giving the very best advice that they possibly can. But after a while, the conversation to most people starts to sound up, down, equity, general, blah, blah, bond, blah, blah, blah. And eventually they just go, and they don't want to look stupid. So they go, oh, yeah, you know what? I think you're absolutely right. And and off the financial advisor goes, and 99% of the time, it's absolutely great. The advice is good and solid. People are monitored and vetted and regulated, and you're probably going to be fine.
I'm shrugging to that.
You're shrugging.
I think there's a lot of unfortunately bad advice out there. Yeah, it's just one of those things. But there's ways that you can protect yourself, because you're either going to try and understand the investments that you're going into. You're going to use your advisor as a sounding board and someone that can educate you and teach you about advice, which I think is most of the Money Show listeners. I mean, you're probably not listening to the Money Show and trying to educate yourself about money if you're not interested in that. But so I think that is key. But the other thing is, I suppose, is to try and work out who is the right person to trust. If you're not going to understand the investments at the end, you need to put in place some sort of checks and balances on your financial advisor. You're essentially not looking at his underlying investments and going through the five P's. You're doing them on your advisor himself. And there you need to look. Are they a certified financial planner? Do they have a qualification that is appropriate for the advice that they're giving? Are they regulated? Are you checking their license? Who is the parent company that you're working with? What is their track record? What is their history? You need to do your due diligence on your advisor. Absolutely. If you're not going to do your due diligence on the underlying investments.
Yeah, and part of that discussion is, you know, at least I think the same way as you find a plumber or an electrician is you contact your best friend and you say, do you know a good electrician? They go, oh, Johnny's the best. And off you go to Johnny and, you know, your house burns down. That can happen. But in the same way as very few people will blindly go and see a financial advisor. You've got to use your networks and go to people who are reliable and who've got that track record that you talk about. When it comes to hedge funds specifically, though, and if we're talking to our financial advisors, what should we be asking them to assess the sort of risk we might be taking going into a particular hedge fund?
You need to try and understand the strategy behind the hedge fund and why that hedge fund is being included in your portfolio. I think maybe a good rule of thumb and one that we try to follow as well. And of course, this is a very much a rule of thumb. Your advisor should be tailoring this advice to you. And I don't know everyone who's listening on this, so I can't say that. But, you know, 10 to 15% of a portfolio potentially in alternative investments is reasonable. If you're starting to see your advisor going way outside that band and you're ending 50%, 60% in hedge funds, there's something going on there. Be very concerned. It is an alternative strategy to try and smooth out your overall performance. So it should be generally a smaller portion of your overall asset allocation. I think that's important. But also get them to explain. I mean, that's what these financial advisors are there for as well. Like they should have at least been to a conference with the managers of that fund. They should know everything about that fund, and you should be able to grill them, and they should have the answers. And if they don't have the answers around the fund that they are recommending to you, you should be incredibly concerned. That should be the first warning bell.
Taking all of your money and taking it somewhere else.
Absolutely. I mean, they need to know the ins and outs of that fund, how it operates. Anything that you can think of to ask them, they should at least be able to answer you. So I think those are kind of little triggers that you can kind of almost set up and try and use to kind of work out whether this is valid advice or not.
And again, I mean, I put a lot of sway in good financial advice, but you shouldn't be blind to financial advice because, and I think it's tougher to do now, but there were times where investment financial advisors were putting people into dodgy investment schemes. And there was the collapse of a trust recently. The man, the Synstidian's chairman, I've forgotten his name already, who handed himself up to the cops for his own protection because he'd lost people's money. And I mean, this is, it can happen. And so you've got to be massively circumspect in people with whom you take huge advice and who
absolutely you should. And what you've got to look at, I think maybe a couple other triggers that you can look for is what is the redemption period on the funds as well, like how easily can you get your money in and out of it. And typically in the hedge fund industry, that is going to be longer than if you think about a share investment, settlement is T+3, so it's 3 days. You sell your share, 3 days later the cash lands in your JSETS account and you pay it out. It's super simple. But a lot of the redemptions on a hedge fund can be a month, it can be 6 months,
because they don't. I mean, they've got investment strategies in place and they've got to be able to calmly exit investments.
Exactly
at a
right.
Point
and that's the kind of question that it's not a warning sign if there's a long redemption period. But before you invest, you should know that. If you're trying to understand if your financial advisor is giving you good advice, think about it. What do you need the money for? If you say, well, I might need the money to buy my new car, and he goes, oh, well, that's great. We can't take high risk because we can't take volatility. This hedge fund's going to be great. You know, it's got a very low volatility return.
And it's got a good track record.
It's got a great track record. You go put it in, and you say, but I might need that car in a month's notice, and there's a 6-month redemption period. Bad advice. Get rid of it.
Yes. Important. And again, that is something I hadn't considered, the redemptions factor, because, you can get in and out of unit trusts fairly easy. You can certainly get in and out of shares very easily. The JSE's got a very good mechanism for that. But you've also, it is about understanding, one, the upside opportunity that you're investing in, because that's the exciting bit. But understand that you are going to have a huge amount of pain if and when, and investments do go up and down, these things do start declining and you go, I want to get out. And you find the doors and the windows are all locked and you can't get out and the house is on fire. Good analogy, the house one, by the way. So you've got to be very, very careful about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Be very, very careful. But overall as well, hedge funds, I think they tend to be very attractive because people are also naturally risk averse as well. So if someone comes to you, as you said, if you think of that, like, the risk reward kind of ratio, typically low risk, low reward, high risk, high reward. And if someone comes offering you, no, there's no risk to this, but it's super high reward. Of course, that's going to sound attractive. And naturally people are risk averse. So if you come and say, oh, it's non-correlated returns, we've never had a negative year, but we can still give you equity like performance. I mean, that is a very exciting sales pitch to get involved with. And as I said, just, I think, apply your mind, look at the tracker, look at the people, look at the processes, know who you're dealing with. Understand what the limitations and the drawbacks are. Understand the fees on the funds, and you should be fine. And they can offer incredible one returns and fantastic risk adjusted returns specifically because they can lower the volatility in your portfolio nicely.
Gary Boyson is a director at Rand Swiss.